Department of Energy.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is Monday, May 21st, 2018. We are the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources, and we are here in one another's company briefly. How's that for an opening? We're going to have to be on the floor at 3 o'clock. And so, although we had three items of business for today, we're only going to be able to attend to the first, the one having to do with Lost Valley Ranch. And even there, we're going to push it as long as we can. And unless we receive special dispensation from the Pope, we will have to, we may not be able to get to all of our presenters, but including our first two who don't seem to be here.
Well, it is Lost Valley. It could be lost.
It could be.
Bill Hansel?
Yeah, we were going to hear from the electeds in that area.
He's getting beat up by the governor.
let me just say while we're waiting, I think probably everyone in this room is familiar with the challenges that Lost Valley Ranch has posed really since the beginning of its since its inception and continues to at this time. And we it is it's an unfolding story. You know, if we when we come back in September, we will probably be in a different place in that story. But what we really want to explore today is what is the record of how the Lost Valley Ranch permit was developed, to what extent was this a failure? I think most of us will agree that this is a story of a failure. Was it a failure of personalities? Was it a failure of our entire CAFO program? Was it, you know, was it a failure of that we can learn some lessons to make sure that it's not repeated? And so that's the purpose of today's hearing. So to that end, I'd like to start off by hearing from our agency friends who I think are going to walk us through the timeline, the record of the experience with Lost Valley Ranch. And so I'll ask Alexis Taylor and Tom Beiler to come up, please. And is it just you two presenting?
Yes.
Great.
All right, well, thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Alexis Taylor, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Tom Beiler, Director at the Oregon Water Resources Department.
We greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk a little bit about the CAFO program and then walk through the permitting process for Lost Valley. I'd also like to introduce Leah Felden, who is Deputy Director at the Department of Environmental Quality. She is also joining us here today. I think it's actually really fitting that Director Beiler and myself are testifying together because the state has been very coordinated through this complicated permitting process, and we appreciate the opportunity to really walk the committee through that permitting process. I should mention the Confined Animal Feeding Operation, CAFO is the acronym for that. So before we got into Lost Valley, we wanted to ensure that the committee had a solid understanding of the CAFO program in Oregon. The purpose of the CAFO program is to work with animal operators to ensure that manure management practices are protective of ground and surface water. ODA administers this program through a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Environmental Quality, and we have done this for over 25 years. There are really two different types of CAFO permits in Oregon. There is the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, the NPDES permit, which is a federal permit. And then there's the Water Pollution Discharge Elimination Systems permit, the WPCF permit, which is a state permit. Up until a few years ago, Oregon permitted all CAFOs under the NPDES permit. However, a federal decision stated that EPA could not require facilities that have a potential to pollute to be required to have the NPDES permit. However, Oregon law does require CAFOs with a wet waste system to have a permit. So really, we created a two-permit system in the state. CAFO operators can elect to the NPDES permit, and roughly 75% of them do. I should say that they do so not because they discharge or pollute, because the CAFO permits are zero discharge, but because it allows additional protections for them. There are a few differences between the two permits, between the NPDES and the WPCF permits. One is around length that the permits are for. The NPDES permit is for 5 years. The WPCF permit is for 10 years. And then another difference is around the reporting requirements. Both are required to maintain the same set of records, but only the NPDES permit is required to submit an annual report to the Department of Agriculture. I should also mention that the program under the NPDES permit and the WPCF permit both have a general permit, which most of the facilities are registered to. However, both have the option to have an individual permit. I will talk about those differences a little later on, but generally that individual permit allows us to really tailor some specifics to a certain operation. We wanted to also give the committee really a breakdown of what the CAFO picture and then the CAFO dairy picture looks like in the state. We have, as of last month, 516 CAFOs registered in the state, and just under half of them are dairies, so 206 of them are dairies. You can see we broke it down by size by the number of dairy cows. If this was a goat dairy, those numbers would be different. But you can see the small, medium, and large breakdown for CAFO permit sizes for dairies. The goal of the program, the CAFO program, is to inspect each permitted operation once every 10 months. That's intentionally that it rotates and moves up 2 months every year, so we can see a facility during multiple seasons. As everyone can imagine, in Oregon, what happens in June will look very different when it's raining in January. And so we want to cycle through our inspections at different times of the year to really see that facility being tested. Last year, on those 500, little over 500 CAFOs we had, we conducted 880 inspections. Less than 1% of those total inspections resulted in violations that led to civil penalties or other injunctive relief. I want to highlight that point because of the philosophy that the CAFO program has been built on for over 20 years. We have an approach that we call the progressive compliance at the Department of Agriculture. We want people in compliance with their permits, and we work with them when we find issues early on and throughout the process to really ensure compliance. And I think our inspection numbers and that less than 1% number being issued in civil penalties really highlights that fact of how we have worked with the regulated industry in Oregon for compliance. One of the things that I find interesting that oftentimes people think the CAFO program is only dairies in the state. Obviously, that is not true. Other types of CAFOs, they could obviously be any type of animal agriculture. Essentially, it's do they have confined animals for a certain amount of time, and do they have a wet waste facility, storage facility? This can include dog kennels, or it includes the wildlife safari down in Douglas County. They have a CAFO permit through the Department of Agriculture as well. So I'd like to walk through what the application process and materials really look like for a brand new facility in the state. First, there's an application to register, and this is just collecting some basic information on the CAFO operator, owner, and proposed facility. We need a land use compatibility statement completed by the county, which just demonstrates whether or not the proposed activity is consistent with those local land use, with the local land use. We need an animal waste management plan. This is all about really the manure management activities, how much manure will be generated, how that manure is to be stored, how that manure will be applied to land, et cetera. I think of those two things. There's the CAFO permit, and then there's the animal waste management permit, and they are both critical components and key components. I think of the CAFO permit that it sets the boundary on the number of animals, and the animal waste management plan sets that day-to-day operation of how that nutrient is going to be managed. Under the animal waste management plan is really the first place ODA touches water. We will touch water twice in our dairy permitting process in the state. The other one is under food safety, and I'll mention that at the next slide. But under the animal waste management plan, we need to ensure that the facility has enough water to ensure or to apply manure onto the land that they have in a certain amount of acres at an agronomic rate. And so that's where we're looking at the amount of water that they have to apply that nutrient at an agronomic rate over a certain amount of land. Also, with the construction of a new facility, all manure storage facilities that are to be constructed also have to be approved. This means an Oregon engineered stamped drawings along with site maps, operation and maintenance plans all need to be approved by ODA prior to construction. Also, with a brand new CAFO facility, or excuse me, a brand new large CAFO facility, and for again, for this is for a dairy farm, 700 head of mature dairy cows or more, there is a public notice and public participation period. This includes a 35-day public comment period with the opportunity to have a public hearing. One thing to note is there is, on those individual permits that I mentioned early on, there's an automatic hearing for any individual permit, whether it's new or a renewal of the permit, because again, permits are good for 5 years under the NPDES permit or 10 years under the WPCF permit. So, while ODA and DEQ jointly administer and permit under the CAFO program, another place for dairy to be sold in the state is under the food safety program at ODA. As a dairy farm, they need to have a grade A milk license, and that's also issued by the department. Oregon has adopted the Pasteurized Milk Ordinance, or PMO, which really is federal standards for dairy farms and processing plants. The PMO dictates a few things. Construction of the milking parlor, so are the parlor surfaces easily cleaned? Operation and maintenance of the parlor, so the milk has to be cooled to a certain temperature over a certain time frame. And setting milk standards. So, for example, every load of milk is tested for bacteria count, antibiotic residues, those types of things. This is also the second place ODA touches water, as I mentioned in the previous slide. What we are requiring is sufficient potable water to wash out the milking facility. You cannot get a grade A license without this, and you cannot sell milk in the state of Oregon without a grade A license. So, shifting gears from the CAFO, the CAFO program generally, to the Lost Valley's permitting process specifically here. So, Lost Valley was issued an individual NPDES permit. So, as I mentioned, of those 506 CAFO facilities in the state, 500 of them are on the general permit, 6 are on the individual. As a general rule, if a CAFO is in a environmentally sensitive area, or if we've had compliance issues, or They're proposing to use some kind of experimental technology. We would put them on an individual permit in those three instances. Because of the groundwater management area, which Lost Valley was proposed to be in, we required them to be on an individual permit. We went through a very extensive monitoring program through the CAFO permit with Lost Valley. Really, again, going back to the intent and purpose of the CAFO program is to protect ground and surface water. And so we would say it's one of the most extensive monitoring in place for any CAFO in the state. This meant we have 11 groundwater monitoring wells, double-lined lagoons with leak detection between the liners. All right, well, now I will walk through a few of the really key components during the permitting process. So in August of 2015, Lost Valley submitted an initial application to ODA for the confined animal feeding operation general permit. ODA asked that it submit a NPDES permit instead to an individual permit, again, because they were in the groundwater management area. Lost Valley, in April of 2016, Lost Valley submitted their complete application for the NPDES individual permit. Then on June 28th, ODA and DEQ issued a public notice of the CAFO application, the individual permit, and the permit evaluation report. In July 28th of 2016, we held a public hearing in Boardman, Oregon. We had approximately 80 individuals show up to that public hearing. Seven individuals provided oral testimony. Six of those oral comments were in favor, and one raised concerns at that time. In September 13th of 2016, ODA met with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. On September 23rd, ODA and DEQ met with Oregon's Environmental Justice Task Force regarding the proposed dairy. At that meeting, we received a request from the Environmental Justice Task Force to extend the comment period. On October 3rd, ODA and DEQ did just that, and we extended the comment period and developed an additional outreach plan, particularly to those environmental justice communities in the area. On October 5th, ODA and DEQ again met with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. On November 4th, the extended comment period closed. ODA and DEQ received just over 4,000 responses. Of those 4,100 responses, half were from outside the state, and so just over 2,000 were from Oregonians. Of those 2,000 from Oregonians, 20 we received from Morrow and Umatilla counties, with really the overwhelming majority of them being supportive of the facility.
A majority of the 20.
Of the 20.
In the local.
Yes, sir. Yes.
Actually, Alexis, could you go back?
Yes.
Tom, I know this is kind of jumping ahead, but at what point did water quantity obligations need to get lined up in this process?
Chair Dembro, again, for the record, my name is Tom Beiler, the director at the Oregon Water Resources Department. In 2016, I don't have the specific dates, but as early as 2016, we were receiving what we call limited licenses, which are fixed duration, short-term uses that are often used in conjunction with construction of facilities. And so we were in conversations and issuing those types of limited licenses for those purposes during that time period, that early time period.
And so was it your sense at this point that there was going to be enough water?
Mr. Chair, we certainly were in understood that it was a water-constrained environment, and I'll talk about that in my remarks. There are a number of tools that are available to anyone seeking to find a new source of water for a new use, and I'll kind of walk the committee through the options that they explored.
Okay. All right. At some point, I'm going to want to kind of plug that into this timeline. Great.
Okay. Chair Dembro, Alexis Taylor, again for the record, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So on March 31st, 2017, ODA and DEQ issued the individual MPDES CAFO permit for Lost Valley. I would say here the average process takes 180 days. This took just under 1 year to permit. On April 20th, the CAFO individual MPDES permit became effective. There is a 20-day waiting period from when that permit is issued to when it can become effective. Then on May 12th, ODA, the Food Safety Program, issued the Grade A milk license was approved. On June 28th of 2017, we issued our first notice of noncompliance and plan of correction for permit violations relating to the waste storage facilities. Then on October 6th of 2017, we issued another notice of noncompliance and plan of correction for additional permit violations relating to waste storage, operation and maintenance of wastewater lagoons, and failure to report the discharge to ODA within 24 hours of the event. That's an important component. As I mentioned earlier, that less than 1% of our inspection work results in civil penalties or injunctive relief, partly because of the way the program is structured. We work closely with the regulated community, and part of the permit is that they are required to report to ODA. Then on November 17th, ODA issued another notice of noncompliance and plan of correction action for permit violations related, again, to waste storage, operation and maintenance of the wastewater lagoons, and failure to report a discharge to ODA within 24 hours of the event. On January 25th, ODA issued a notice of civil penalty for those permit violations leading up until November. For overflow of wastewater onto surfaces not designed for wastewater storage, failure to report those discharges within 24 hours of the event. On February 8th, ODA issued another notice of noncompliance and plan of corrective action for permit violations relating to the operator violating the freeboard space of the lagoon. Essentially, what freeboard is between the wastewater and the top of the lagoon. You need sufficient space so when winds and when it can become quite windy and boardmen come through, the wastewater doesn't overtop the lagoon, and we had problems there. So then on February 15th, ODA issued another notice of noncompliance and plan of corrective action, again, for permit violations regarding freeboard of the lagoon and discharging. On February 16th of 2018, ODA, at this point, and that compliance history, and the compliance history of particularly of them not calling us in when there were problems, ODA went to the Multnomah County Circuit Court and requested a temporary restraining order to suspend all waste production at the facility. The judge then on March 16th granted a stipulated judgment at the Multnomah County Circuit Court. So what the stipulated judgment, in our opinion, really did was work really hand-in-hand with the CAFO program. It really made the court a partner in ensuring compliance or trying to ensure compliance with a different set of tools for demanding compliance. We have administrative tools, civil penalties, and we decided to go to the court to try and stop enforce compliance of this facility, which really brought the court's tools and contempt of court as another option when they violated compliance.
Alexis, how frequently does that happen?
Very rarely. Again, because of the way the program has been set up with the regulated community, we are working with CAFO operators, and so long as they're able and willing to work with us, we do not get there. But it's really when an operator is unable or unwilling to be in compliance, and through that progressive compliance approach that the department has. So it's not that often. And then on April 23rd, of 2018, again, we issued a notice of noncompliance and a plan of correction, again, for permit violations regarding their failure to complete their 2017 annual report, manure overtopping the lagoons, and the liquid transfer pipe being clogged. So one item that we also requested to talk about is the Administrative Procedures Act, because that is the APA as is really what dictates actions by agencies in the state, and certainly our actions at the Department of Agriculture. It governs how we adopt rules, take enforcement action, and the rights of individuals affected by those agency actions. Some of the things it affords individuals is the notice, a notice to the affected individual, the ability to challenge an agency's action, the right for a hearing of the action before an administrative law judge, and ultimately the right to appeal a final order to the circuit court. Again, this process really governs our enforcement action at the Department of Agriculture, and that is part of the reason why we find notice of noncompliance, and you see that multiple times through the course of last year, and that first civil penalty being issued in January, is because of that public APA and the rights afforded to them, and then there's a process after that for them to be able to appeal those civil penalties as well in that public engagement process.
So it sets out the due process mechanism for regulated entities then?
Chair Dumbrough, members of the committee, absolutely. It is due process for individuals for the action that the state may be taking.
Is there ever a time that, because of the extremity of the situation, that you can leap ahead in the due process?
Chair Dumbrough, I would like to be able to get that back to you in writing. In my And I have not experienced that, but I've just been in Oregon state government for just over a year. So if we could provide that to the committee back in writing, we would appreciate that. So animal agriculture, like dairy farming, is highly regulated in Oregon. And I just wanted to kind of give a snapshot of the different permits that were needed for a facility such as the size of Lost Valley. This is just the state permits and licenses that are necessary. This is not necessarily take into account any local or county permits or licenses that might be needed. As I mentioned earlier, the state has been very coordinated through a complicated permitting process, partially because of the water issues in the area, but also because of, and really I would say rightly so, our respective agencies' public engagement processes that are there, and ensuring that we were staying coordinated was really key to moving through the process for certainly my agency at ODA, and then also our counterparts at DEQ and WRD. With that, I will turn it over to Director Beiler.
Thank you, Chair Dumbrough, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Tom Beiler with the Oregon Water Resources Department. I appreciate the opportunity to appear today to talk about Lost Valley and the water use related issues associated with that operation. I have, you have in your possession, I think a three-page document that lines out the different water-related transactions that have been in play over the course of the last year and a half or so. I don't plan on going into that level of detail for purposes of my presentation. I have a handful of slides that I want to walk you through, but I want to give you a sense of the playing field from a water resources standpoint that Lost Valley has had to go through to meet their water needs. At the outset, though, I want to reiterate a point Director Taylor made, that about the level of coordination and communication between the agencies, both on the permitting side and also at the place of at the operation itself. There's been really strong communication and coordination. We all know we have different programs that we're responsible for administering, that level of coordination and communication and, frankly, professionalism from our staff has been excellent. I would also add that you don't have to have a big dairy project in order to receive that kind of coordination between the agencies. There's really a culture of coordination among the agencies that I've experienced through my career with state government. In terms of water rights, just to set the table briefly, you all know that water is, by under state law, a public resource, and the Water Resources Department is the agency that is charged with the responsibility of managing the use of that public resource. And we do so primarily through water rights that are based on seniority system. But there are a number of tools that are available to folks to be able to make use of water. Water rights certainly being the one that people tend to think of the most. There are also opportunities for folks to transfer rights, either the rights that they hold to different purposes or different place of use or different point of diversion, or to obtain a use of a water right via transfer from a third party, a neighbor, for example. People can make use of water through long-term contracts or short-term contracts with municipal entities who often have pretty large water rights that have great flexibility within them in terms of the types of uses. So that's yet another opportunity out there. There are a range of exempt uses, uses that don't require water rights, from both surface water and groundwater, that folks can pursue as well. And lastly, limited licenses are these short-term, limited duration uses other than irrigation that folks can make for things like construction is often a use that we would see under that type of authorization. I walked through these because we're actually going to talk about a little bit about all of these because they were all part of the consideration by Lost Valley as we worked with them. So I also want to say that whether you're a large user seeking a new source of water or a small user, it is a tough environment to work in terms of finding water use around the state. It's just the reality, and the state water code was passed in 1909, so we've been 109 years into implementing the code. There are many water uses that predate 1909. Water is simply not as available today as it was 20, 30, 50 years ago. And that makes for a complicating and challenging environment for any new user, whether you're a large dairy or whether you're an individual just seeking to make a water use. One of the things that's important to us as an agency is to make sure that we provide some technical advice to folks in terms of what tools may or may not be available to them that they may want to consider in terms of meeting their needs. And we certainly did that and provided that feedback with the dairy as they considered their options. So, the saying, location, location, location. Well, it applies to water use as well, and one's options can may have more opportunities or less opportunities depending on where you're located. And so this map shows a portion of Northeast Oregon. The left half of the map is Morrow County. The right side is Umatilla County. And those polygons that are colored yellow and orange are groundwater administrative areas that were designated by the Oregon Water Resources Commission and Department to manage groundwater in areas where we saw significant declines in the past. The state law requires that we manage groundwater in a sustainable fashion, and I think that's primarily to protect the users on those systems so that they have a reliable source over time. These were areas by the 1970s and 1980s that we were seeing dramatic declines of groundwater levels. And so a number of groundwater management area designations were developed. Those orangish areas are what we call critical groundwater areas, and it's the most limiting and probably comprehensive tool that we have to manage groundwater where we see significant declines. If you look in the kind of the that horizontal box that you see where it says ordinance gravel, on the left-hand side of that, left-hand border of that area, below I-84, which is the black line that goes horizontally through this map, right along that edge of the of that ordinance gravel line, primarily outside of it, is where the Lost Valley Dairy exists. And so you can tell that they're located in an area that has some limitations. And those limitations, more specifically for critical groundwater area, is that we don't issue new groundwater rights in those areas. They're done in terms of new uses. We're really trying to rebuild the sustainability of those areas and protect those existing users who are already on those systems. So that certainly created a daunting task for the dairy or anyone who would try to make use of water in that area, knowing that you already have these limited systems. I would add that in the Umatilla-Morrow County area, surface water has been fully allocated in the Umatilla Basin, so that is not an easy option. The Columbia River does provide a source of water in the wintertime, but I'll talk about that a little bit because that has some complications as well.
Tom, but the operation that was that preceded Lost Valley, the tree farm there, they had water rights, right?
Correct. Correct.
And the owners of Lost Valley, in purchasing the land, they were also purchasing the water rights?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Water rights do run with the land. So if you sell your property, those water rights stay with the property. And you're right on the mark in terms of where I was headed. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the authorizations and the options that were explored by Lost Valley. And I'll tell you in this, Mr. Chair, this gets to your question earlier about our involvement and the timing around that. And while I don't have a specific, as specific a timeline as Director Taylor provided for you, I can tell you that our staff were engaged very early in this process. And one of the things that we mentioned to Lost Valley early on was our concerns about the use of groundwater. The one thing to bear in mind with a critical groundwater area, or at least the critical groundwater area in play here, which is called Ordinance Basalt critical groundwater area, is that while we limit new water rights, we don't limit exempt uses under that that designation. And that means either surface water or groundwater exempt uses can be used. Now, typically, an exempt use most often is for domestic purposes, but stock watering is also an eligible use under that. And so we recognized, given the size, proposed size of this project, of this operation, that would be in conflict with our goals under the critical groundwater area. And we expressed our discomfort with them trying to move forward to supply water for the operation with the exempt use approach. To Lost Valley's credit, they did spend a considerable amount of time and effort looking at alternatives, and I want to walk you through those alternatives. So as Chair Dembro mentioned, the Lost Valley did, and they do have water rights. They have surface water rights for irrigation purposes, and they are using those water rights as part of their dairy operation to grow crops that provide feed for the cows on the dairy. But they also need, in order to be able to operate, they need a water right that can satisfy the dairy operations. There are a number of different water uses associated with managing a dairy, including but not limited to water for drinking for the cows. The problem they had with their irrigation rights and why those didn't satisfy their needs right up front is that it wasn't of drinking water quality for the cows, one. And secondly, they weren't able to deliver that water in the wintertime because of the limitations of the delivery systems for the Columbia Irrigation District, which is the entity responsible for delivering those water rights. So they need year-round operations, and they need to have a potable source of water. And that water right, their existing water rights, only covered so much of that territory for them. New water rights are not an option. As I've mentioned, groundwater is cut off because of the critical groundwater area. for new permits and surface water fully appropriated. The Columbia River does provide a potential option in the winter, but again, there isn't the infrastructure to be able to deliver that in the wintertime currently, and there would be considerable expense to be able to build that. So the next option on the list is a permanent transfer, and this is was really kind of the I think the best option and continues to be the best option for any operation in that area. And the proposal essentially involved Lost Valley transferring a portion of their surface water rights to a neighbor. And in return, the neighbor is proposing to transfer their basalt groundwater rights to Lost Valley. That is permissible under our critical groundwater area because it's not a net increase of use of water, of groundwater. That's already an existing use under the within that critical groundwater area, and would provide that year-round potable source that the dairy was seeking. We issued proposed orders in the spring of 2017 approving those two transfers. The transfer, and they were two separate transfer transactions. The transfer that proposed to move the groundwater rights from the neighbor to the Lost Valley operation was protested, by in two separate instances, one by a neighbor who was concerned about injury to their existing uses, and the second was by a group of conservation interests. Those protesters are continue to be pending at this time. So the Lost Valley, I think, understood that given the profile of this project, that they might run into protests for their long-term use, this permanent transfer. And so they looked at some alternative plans to be able to meet their needs. Our understanding was that they needed to start moving cattle to the location in the spring of 2017, and that they didn't have an alternative option. And so we did work with them to explore alternatives to be able to meet their water needs. And there were several that came into play. One was some limited licenses. Again, these are short-term, temporary authorizations that tend to be lowest on the totem pole in terms of how we manage water. But they do provide a mechanism for short-term use. They explored two options. One was for alluvial groundwater. This is not the basalt, which tend to be the deeper groundwater sources, but these are the more shallow gravel source. They had some wells that were outside of the ordinance gravel area, that is that horizontal lines that you may recall on the map that I showed you in the previous slide. We approved the limited license for that that use, which would have provided a source of water for their operations, some construction, as well as, I believe, some drinking water for the cows. That limited license was contested through a petition for judicial review, which then, speaking of the APA, would then put that issue in front of the local circuit court. I can't remember if it was local circuit court, frankly, or Marion County, but in any event, it would be in front of a circuit court. The Lost Valley folks ultimately withdrew their request, which mooted that issue. The other limited license they looked at was for basalt groundwater. And ultimately, they withdrew their application before we made a decision on a final order associated with that. That one was a little more complex from the standpoint of whether it was a permissible use given the groundwater limitations under the critical groundwater area. But they did, it is worth noting that over the course of 2017, the neighbor who they intended to do the permanent transfer with, transferring their groundwater rights over to Lost Valley, agreed to forbear on the use of their groundwater during 2017. from our standpoint, that took a lot of pressure off the system from the standpoint that if Lost Valley were to use groundwater under that limited license that they were proposing, it could have been offset by the forbearance of their neighbor.
So did that all happen after there were already cows on the property?
Mr. Chair, these were items that were all in discussion during that time when they were starting to move cows onto the property. And I believe the initial limited license for the alluvial wells was issued right as they were starting to move cattle onto their property. And I believe that was part of their initial source of water. I would note that their surface water rights are for irrigation purposes and for what we call incidental agricultural uses. Those uses can help with some of the operational needs for a dairy. But again, that surface water source is not adequate for the drinking water purposes for the cows. So they had some options as they started to move cows onto the dairy property. Mm-hmm. They also Mr. Chair,
One of the concerns that I've heard expressed is that there were cows on the property before the source of water was really nailed down for the cattle to drink. Yeah. Is that a fair assessment, looking back on this?
Mr. Chair, I think they did have authorized and legal sources of water as they moved cows onto the property.
But it wasn't clear those were going to be reliable and ongoing. It was kind of ad hoc and cobbled together.
Mr. Chair, they did not have resolved their long-term source of water at that time. And the last item just on that point is that they also had as a backstop an agreement with the Port of Morrow, who have a municipal use water right, to be able to truck water to the location to be able to meet their needs. So as they started to move cows onto the property, we knew that they had an array of kind of temporary uses and authorizations or arrangements that didn't require our feedback or permission. In order for them to be able to meet their needs for the dairy.
And Tom, since you've paused, colleagues, you should know that our friends in the House are still on the floor and talking away, I think. So
we're carrying
the on. Assessment is we have another 40 minutes or so.
On a good day, 40 minutes.
Right. Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions on the water. It would probably be a good time to ask them.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Could you identify what sources are approved for stock water without water rights in the state of Oregon?
Senator Bertschinger, one can use water for stock watering purposes without a water right for groundwater purposes or from a groundwater source. That is what we call an exempt use under the statutes. It's unlimited under the groundwater statutes. For surface water, there's more limited access for stock watering, where you have to have a kind of a trough and return system. But there's also an option under the surface water source. So there's two exempt uses that don't require a water use authorization under the state law.
Tom, could you just explain for us what stock water is and who can use stock water?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I think Director Taylor mentioned that when we talk about stock, we talk about that as livestock. There is, it could be pigs, it could be sheep, it could be cattle. There's a range of animals that are eligible for that use. I think we tend to think mainly in terms of cattle and ranches, but there's a broader array of livestock that could use that exemption.
Even if they're in a capo situation?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Follow up. So in this particular case then, we have some surface rights. Where are the surface rights? Where are they coming from?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartschiger, the surface water rights that are held by Lost Valley are from the Columbia River, and they are distributed through the Columbia Improvement District. It's an irrigation district in that area. There aren't any, I'm not aware of any other surface water sources that are nearby, natural sources that are nearby that would be feasible for them to be able to access.
So Columbia River water would be stock water, could be construed as stock water?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bertschiger, I think it would be tough to, if you're asking about whether the Columbia River water could be used as an exempt use, I think
for
that.
For stock water.
For stock water, I think that would be a difficult case to make because you're literally miles away from the river, and the way the surface water exemption is set up, as I understand it, you have to return the water. You have to have a kind of a closed system that returns the surface water back to its original source. That'd be very difficult for them to do in this circumstance.
The water from the Columbia River, Tom, that came with the property. That's just for agricultural purposes, right? Which is why it's not available in the winter. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the existing rights that Lost Valley Dairy has are for irrigation purposes. Irrigation has a season attached to it. One can work around that through the transfer process as long as you don't use more water than you would have during the portion of the irrigation season. But as I mentioned earlier, that's not a suitable, it doesn't meet all of their needs, in particular because two reasons. One, it's not potable, so it wouldn't serve as a drinking water source for the dairy. And secondly, there is no existing system that can deliver that water year-round from the Columbia River to where the dairy exists today.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm still confused that if unlimited groundwater use is for stock water, why they'd have to get limited license for stock water.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bertschiger, if I may, they are authorized to use groundwater under the exemption. Let me be clear about that. That's not unlawful. The concern that we expressed to them was that our concern about our responsibilities to the other groundwater users in that area who are on that system. We have a responsibility at the department to protect the groundwater resource in that area. It is a critical groundwater area, and our concern that we expressed to Lost Valley wasn't that it was an illegal use, but that it was a potentially significant use, and if they intended to use the groundwater exemption over a long period of time, that would be problematic in terms of our ability to be able to protect the existing users on that groundwater system. There are tools that we could utilize to address that situation under existing law, under our critical groundwater area laws, which would involve either a combination of rulemaking, a contested case proceeding, and issuance of an order, depending on how we would approach that. That would take time, and there'd be a lot of public process associated with that. But our concern that we expressed to Lost Valley was really about the long-term management of that groundwater system.
I may, Mr. Chair. So the stock water statutes in the state go back a long time. So I mean, far before we had the groundwater statutes. So how does one prioritize which is more important, and how do you take action against groundwater being used for stock water?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartschiger, I agree with your point. The exemption has been on the books for a long, long time, and it's not limited in terms of how much water could be used. The tools that we have available to us today allow for, I think, pretty significant public process. And if we were to engage the local community around this issue, it would be specific to this critical groundwater area, and there'd be opportunity for Lost Valley, for neighbors and other users of that groundwater system, as well as other local interests and anyone else to weigh in and help inform the decision that would be before the department and our commission.
But they still would be in violation of a statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartschiger, the exempt use of groundwater is lawful in that area today.
Okay. Yes, Senator.
So it is in a critical area, water. What tools do you have to limit anybody's use of groundwater in a critical area, including theirs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, we have available to us today the ability to either do rulemaking, to amend the critical groundwater area to include exempt uses or to somehow limit exempt uses going forward. We also can, under the critical groundwater area, address uses that are affecting the overall system. We would need to have some evidence that there was a problem, and I think today we don't have that, quite honestly, in part because of the neighbor who has agreed to forbear on the use of their groundwater. So I can't sit here today and say that we have an emergency situation where the groundwater is being the system is being damaged significantly by a new use. But our concern has been over the long term that the general purposes of this critical groundwater area were to prohibit new uses that would affect and continue to impact the aquifer system in a negative way. And that really is kind of what our motivation is on this instance. It has little to do with whether a stock water exempt use is acceptable or not. It's more about our desire to, over the long term, protect that groundwater system and the users on it.
I guess where I, you know, in water law, it's first in time, first in line in most cases. And so I'm just trying to get things straight in my head. That's an old statute that groundwater is an exempted use for stock water. So wouldn't that be first in time compared to irrigation wells or something else?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartschiger, exempt wells can have a priority date as well, and they can be regulated. They don't have to go through the permitting process. That's the difference. So the wells associated here would have, I don't know what their priority dates are, but basically when they submitted their paperwork and drilled their wells and submitted that they were intending to use these as an exempt use, that would they would have their place in line based on that information.
Okay. Thank you. That answers.
The use of these exempt wells, though, or the potential use of them, would be really exceptional for CAFOs, would they not be? I mean, we heard this initially characterized as a misuse of the stock water exemption, and that kind of makes sense to me. I'd never heard of, you know, of this exemption being used for an operation of this magnitude or anywhere near this magnitude. Is it, you know, is that just because I'm not familiar with it? But this seems really exceptional.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, Tom Beiler, I don't know what was on the minds of the legislators when they enacted the law in the early 20th century. I think it's fair to say that we didn't have mega dairies at that time. But that doesn't mean that there weren't large uses of exempt groundwater for cattle. I don't know at this point. But I understand the policy question and certainly recognize, given where we are today with the limitations around sources of water and competing needs, they're who are pursuing that water, that these issues can be very difficult and challenging to sort through.
Thank you. Colleagues, other questions? So Alexis, just taking your timeline and bringing it up to the present time, what's going on and what can we expect?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, again for the record, Alexis Taylor, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Going up to the end of the timeline, we have continued to conduct weekly inspections. Roughly, when you look at that timeline over the course of just over a year, our inspections have averaged really once a week. I think we have continued that through the entire process, and we will continue to do that. To try and ensure compliance. However, I think we are at a point from the department's perspective that this operator is not able to comply with the permit. The permit, if they were, I don't believe we would be here today. The permit is environmentally protective. It would protect groundwater. The operator has not been able to comply to that permit. We are, as I said, we are continuing our regulatory process and continuing our inspections. And those will continue to work through the process that we have set up at the department. And we continue to have conversations with our attorneys at the Department of Justice on next steps for the facility.
But as I understand it, Lost Valley has declared bankruptcy, and it's now under the authority of the court. And you're now dealing with the court, right?
Chair Dembro, that is correct. That is really, that bankruptcy proceeding is separate from our compliance work. That does not prevent us from continuing to do those inspections and ensure compliance work. That is a separate legal process, which ODA is also a potential party to, and listed as one of the potential creditors, depending on what happens. I'm not sure we know at this point what will happen under the bankruptcy proceedings.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. In your testimony, Ms. Taylor, you talked about a restraining order for them not to produce any more manure. How do you do that with 16,000 cows standing around?
Chair Dembro,
Senator. They're tough.
So the judge did not issue that temporary restraining order. However, from a practical standpoint, if he had, that would have prevented the dairy from operating. We knew that is still not an immediate process because you have, as you say, I think at most they ever had maybe 10,000 cows there, but you still have to do something with those cows. And so that is, I think, part of the reason that unanswered question on, well, what do you do with those cows? You can't just stop milking them day one. They're still going to produce manure and wet waste. Part of the reason the judge went the route of the stipulated judgment. And from our perspective, we have seen improved compliance from the facility since then. That stipulated judgment, if they did not report compliance issues with the permit, if they did not report them, and what we had seen for the months leading up to going to court and getting that stipulated judgment, them not reporting them within a 24-hour period, they would be held in contempt of court. Well, what we've seen since we've got the stipulated judgment is they have been reporting those to us. So we have seen improvement since getting that stipulated judgment from the courts.
I'll follow up. Another question. In your testimony, you talked about you seem to have conveyance systems that weren't working for the lagoons and stuff like that. What was the reasons why they were not working? Do we know that?
We do. And so as my understanding, and we can certainly follow up in greater detail with summaries of all the notice of noncompliance that we did. Sometimes they were clogged. They weren't being flushed regularly. They're maybe missing some valves and some caps. So different issues at different times, I understand it. But again, we can follow up with summaries of all of those notices of noncompliance to talk about that in greater detail.
Yeah, because trying to, every once in a while, we get what we call frozen manure pipes, and they're very challenging in the wintertime to unfreeze.
Thanks, Senator. Colleagues, we have received word that we're going to be expected on the floor at 3:15. Miracles have happened, and the House has finished its work. And we had a number of people who were prepared to testify and help us sort of probe the policy implications of this experience. I know some have submitted testimony And so it's there on the record, which you can all take a look at. As is, by the way, some information about an item, another item that we had had to cancel from the meeting, having to do with natural gas in the Coos Bay area and the process through Dagami of doing exploration of that gas. But, you know, just coming back to this, we will most likely need to reconvene on this subject come September. I am really interested in seeing what we can do to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again, you know, to make sure that, you know, we don't have an operation that's kind of cobbling different strategies together and getting us into a position where they become, in a sense, too big to fail. And we have these animals on the property, and we have to be concerned about their welfare, obviously. We can't just shut them down. How do we comply with the due process provisions of the Administrative Practices Act, while making sure that we're handling this appropriately and really having the tools to be prepared? So, you know, any of you who would like to help me with this, I would really appreciate it,
but
Senator.
My other concern is we have these unreported spills, and so then you eventually find out about them. Is the cleanup happening so there isn't getting into the surface water, or do we know what's out there with respect to available to get into the system? And I think that would probably be DEQ more than it would be you.
Chair Denbrough, Senator Roblin, as the weekly inspections from our ODA and CAFO inspector are ongoing, part of the notice of noncompliance is a plan of correction. And so as we're finding issues, we're pointing them out, we're asking them to self-correct those issues. Oftentimes we would find manure being stored someplace that it was not permitted to be stored someplace, so we would have them move it. And so we have been working through those issues. We also have been monitoring through those 11 groundwater monitoring wells that were in place. And to date, there have been no environmental impact, and that's what we're working to ensure, and why I would say ODA has been, and our counterparts at DEQ, while it might not seem fast, I would say in the course of the year, roughly a year, we permitted a facility. They were moved cows there. They had permit violations. We found permit violations. We issued several notices of noncompliance. We issued civil penalties. We issued additional notices of noncompliance, and then we took them to court. All of that in the course of a year, really with the vein to ensure that we are protecting the environment in this instance.
So, can I final?
Yes, please.
So when we do permits, do we have any assurance that through a bond or whatever, that we can recover, say, if there's a bankruptcy, other kinds of things? Do we do that when issuing permits at all?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Roblin, we do not.
Okay.
Here at the department, under the CAFO program, we do not have a bonding requirement. I am not a bonding expert. the little bit I do know, it's one of the impacts is for that environmental cleanup. And to date, there would be nothing to really recoup that bond on.
Okay, that's fair.
Mm-hmm. Could there ever come a time where the agency might need to step in and operate the facility to protect the welfare of the animals? I'm just thinking, I mean, we have been talking about having a bond and just making sure that the department has the resources to be able to do that.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, I think there are instances and certainly options we're discussing with our attorneys at the Department of Justice, potentially not the department taking over ownership, but requesting the courts to appoint someone.
That is, it is something we're talking. We do have requirements like that in some of our mining operations, and you know, so we have talked about for an operation of this size, or you know, a sizable operation, that would probably be appropriate.
I would be a poor CAFO operator.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both very much for being here. And to the audience, again, I apologize. We had another probably 45 minutes to an hour of good conversation around this topic, and you'll just have to wait for that. But in the meantime, do consult the meeting materials, see what's posted there, and feel free to be in communication with us.
Yeah, if they want to submit stuff to the record.
Yes, certainly if you have something to submit to the record, that would be great.
So we're not coming back after we get on the floor.
No, we're on the floor.
Okay, so with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.
I know, I was just asking. I know.